This episode is brought to you by Jamie Gibson and Andre Wasilko, two people who recently decided they would pledge money to the Creative Control with Vishkana Patreon page. And I want to thank you, Jamie and Andre. It means a lot. And you've gotten us up to $223 per month. And if you're just, if you don't know what I'm talking about, we are trying to get this show's Patreon page up to $500 per month by the end of August 2015. If we do not achieve this goal of $500 a month, the show will stop at the end of August. And so if you want the show to continue, please pledge today. You pledge a monthly amount. You can stop anytime. You can pledge whatever you want. But there is a special incentive for people who pledge at least $4 a month between July and August. You all, and everyone who's pledged thus far, actually, receives a t-shirt, a Creative Control t-shirt. At least three designs are in play, and we may have them in hand quite soon, and I will be sharing these designs with everyone the best way I can. I will try to contact each of you who have pledged directly and say, hey, here's what I have to offer you, and tell me your size. So if you're interested in a t-shirt, let me know, and we'll figure it out. I'll tell you what sizes are available, and we'll see what we can do. Everybody else, if you haven't pledged yet and you wanted to see the show continue, please pledge today. Again, patreon.com/creativecontrol. There's more information at vishkana.com and this show's Facebook page. So let's keep going. I want to keep going. Damn it.
Creative Control with Vishkana.
Good show for you this episode, but before I get to that, a couple of things. First of all, my ancient, relatively speaking, computer came back from the shop, and it seems to be working fine. The podcast-making machine seems to be working. I mean, I hope so. If you can hear this, the damn thing is working. So thanks to John Zhang at PC Trust in Guelph for fixing my computer. He put a new hard drive in it. He didn't lose anything miraculous. He said the hard drive was fried, but it didn't lose anything. As far as I can tell, everything's there. I back up some stuff and didn't back up everything, but it's there. It's good. So thank you, John Zhang. Other thing I wanted to make mention of, I don't know what it was. I think it was last year sometime, I think. It must have been, I guess. This show achieved its 100th episode, and to mark the occasion, I had this interview in the can that I didn't quite know what to do with. A local writer, Andrew Nathan Hood, contacted me about interviewing me for research towards his book. He was working on a book about my friend and someone whose music I admire, Jim Guthrie. So he says, can we have a chat? I said, why don't you just come on the CFRU version of this show? We'll just talk. And at the time, there wasn't even a show after mine. My show is on Wednesdays at noon, and at the time, there wasn't a 1 o'clock show. So we just talked for 2 hours, Andrew and I, about Jim, but also about me, because I don't know, it kind of dovetailed, and that's why I thought it made an interesting 100th episode. Anyway, Andrew's book just came out, and I don't think I've talked about it too much. It's called Who Needs What, and it's out via Invisible Publishing, their bibliophonic series, which mostly profiles Canadian musicians. And I just started reading it like 2 nights ago, and I'm almost done. It's a very short book, and it's great. Love it. Beautifully written, and I'm learning a lot of about my friends and their perspective. So for me, it hits close to home because I was around for a lot of that stuff, and I know some of the people talking. But I think if you want to know more about Canadian music and sort of the dawn of this current enduring renaissance that we're going through in terms of Canadian independent music and its strength, start with this book, Who Needs What, by Andrew Nathan Hood. By the way, I mentioned that was for the 100th episode. The 200th episode of the show is looming, and I've been kind of stalling to get to it because I don't know what I'm going to do special. I'm trying to find a big guest, and it's not working out. I don't know what to do. If you have suggestions for what the 200th episode of this show should look like, at this point, I'm all ears. Email me, Facebook me, whatever it is. I'm going to listen. Tweet at me. I think that's pretty much all the things I do. Please don't phone me. I don't know what to do. So it's coming, though. 200 episodes, and, you know, you and I care, and that's about it, and that's fine. We have each other. We have each other, and that's the deal. I'll work hard. I'm trying. I've been desperately trying for this episode. Anyway, this particular episode, which I guess is episode what? 198 or something. It's good. Nigel Chapman of the Halifax band Nap Eyes is on, and he's got a very interesting story, a very interesting vocational background, a fascinating musician and songwriter, and his band put out a record back in March, and it's called Wine of the Mystic, and then two labels decided they wanted to get behind it and reissue it, so it's back again, and you're going to hear some music from that record and hear some interesting stories about Nigel. He's an interesting guy. So this is myself, Nigel Chapman. Let's enjoy this show.
The 32nd Annual Hillside Festival takes place July 24th, 25th, and 26th at Guelph Lake, rain or shine, featuring performances by Astral Swans, Bad Bad Not Good, Badminton Racket, Baskery, Battle of Santiago, Braids, The Brothers Landreth, Bulgarian Voices Trio, By Divine Right, Tim Chasen, Nels Klein Singers, Constantines, Nick Crane, Alex Cuba, Daka Braka, Del Bell, Daldrums, Echo Deck, Darren Edens, Eloquent, Etiquette, Everlovin' Jug Band, Nick Ferrio, Jeremy Fisher, Frazee Ford, David Francie, Michael Franti and Spearhead, Galacticats, The Good Lovelies, Great Lakes Swimmers, Ash Grunwald, Alana Gurr and The Greatest State, Hungai, The Henrys, Suzanne Jarvie, Mo Kenny, The Cramdens, Daniel Lanois, Last X, Lee Reed, Lids, Look Vibrant, Leluc, Minotaurs, Moonface, The Once, Nancy Pants, Doug Paisley, Fred Penner, Perch Creek, Poor Man's Whiskey, Natalie Prass, The Spring Standard, Jamie Stone's Lomax Project, Sultans of String, Tommy Crest, Team, Thus Owl, Tribecistan, Riley Walker, The Weather Station, Jason Wilson and Pee Wee Ellis, and more to be announced. For more information about purchasing tickets to this accessible event, please visit hillsidefestival.ca.
This week, the Bookshelf Cinema is screening Love and Mercy, Sunshine on Lathe, Jean de Florette, Mad Max Fury Road, Manon de Source, Suite Francaise, and more. And at the E-Bar, Guelph Poetry Slam does a thing on Saturday, July 18th, and Lisa LeBlanc and Ginger St. James perform together on Sunday, July 19th. The Bookshelf is an independently owned cultural hub located at 41 Quebec Street in Guelph. More information about their hours, listings, blogs, and accessibility, please visit bookshelf.ca. Nigel Chapman is the visionary singer and songwriter for a Halifax band called Nap Eyes, featuring members of another Neato band called Monomyth. Nap Eyes released their debut album this past March, and it's recently been reissued in Canada on You've Changed Records and elsewhere in the world via Paradise of Bachelors. The record is called Wine of the Mystic and has prompted Nap Eyes to go on tour, including stops in southern Ontario between July 15th and 18th. Here now to discuss this further is Nigel Chapman. Hi, Nigel. How are you?
Hi, Vish. I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well. Now, where in the world are you?
This morning, I'm in Boise, Idaho. We came here last night to play a show at a place called Neurolux. And now I'm sitting in a park in Boise, and it's really nice.
Do you know much about Boise, Idaho?
Not very much. near this park, there's like a little placard that says we're in like the west end of town. I think that it used to be like kind of all farmland for like maybe for dairy cows and other things. And I think that there's like a little history of how like since the late 1800s and 1900s, it's been converted to neighborhoods. And yeah, and it's nice. That's all. Just about all I know.
Okay.
And the people here are really nice.
Is it? Am I wrong? Maybe I'm confusing. No, I think this is right. Isn't Ronald Reagan from near there?
Whoa, you could be right. Yeah, I don't know, but maybe he is.
I feel like, I hope I'm, maybe it's Iowa. I just remember being on tour and in like 2000, and I remember we crossed into, I thought it was Idaho, and there, or yeah, I think it was. Maybe I'm wrong. I could be wrong. I might be wrong about this. It's probably Iowa. Never. Now I should be fact-checking. I just wondered, do you feel like a particular like American politics seeping through your experience in Boise?
I guess not especially strongly, but things I do notice are like maybe like architecture and neighborhood layout. We just drove through Oregon yesterday, and it's cool seeing like the way the geography has changed a bit. Here in the city, they have a lot of really nice lawns and like big trees, and I'm not sure how much that's because of like things that they practically had to do, like to be deliberate about, or how much grows naturally. But the Oregon Trail was really cool, and it was like kind of super like, I don't know if to say arid at times or something, but really mountainous and gulchy. I don't know actually what that word gulch means. But
Is this your first time traveling in some of these places?
Yeah, like last summer, Napas went down the East Coast a little bit. So we saw like New York City and Boston and like Pittsburgh and stuff, even Baltimore. And I have family down in Baltimore, but as far as the West Coast goes, and like all these Midwestern states, it's all new. So we entered Seattle, and we played in Portland as well. Yeah, so it's really, really cool to see this place.
Okay, cool. No, that's good for you. And so have there been any particular tour highlights thus far? Like you mentioned that you're in a park. That sounds good. But is anything really, really stuck out as being unique?
Yeah, I guess there have been a few great times. We had we were in, always being in Vancouver and Victoria is really nice. The west coast of Canada is so beautiful, and that was only my second time there. So we got to go swimming at like a lake in Victoria, just like outside the city. And it was really, really beautiful and nice. And then when we went south of the border to Seattle, like we got to play like a big, it was on Independence Day on the 4th of July. So there was like a big party with like 12 or 14 bands or something. And yeah, just really, really nice crowds and great kind of community spirit. So it's cool seeing that like being introduced to Seattle in that way, because we know about that place musically for many years, like Nirvana and everything. So.
Sure, yeah. No, significant for sure. Okay, no, it's good. I'm glad you're having a good time. Now you, as far as I understand things, you are on tour away from a pretty unique day job. Am I correct?
I guess so, yeah.
I mean, you do have a day job. You have a day job that's kind of interesting.
That's right. I think, I'm like a research assistant or like a technician in a biochemistry lab at Dalhousie University, where basically I work on a project under my supervisor, Jan Rainey, and I worked on this project like during my master's, which I took at Dalhousie, and then I finished it like last August, and then for about the past 8 months or a year almost, I've been kind of like a part-time research assistant or technician, just still working on the same project, but without the same like curricular stuff, like presentations and thesis is all done. So I've been focusing on just my experiments really.
Okay. So you completed your master's and then they kind of gave you a job?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Which I was very grateful for. It certainly helped a lot. And my supervisor, Jan, has been amazingly like flexible and supportive of kind of both science and music. So so that's really been one of the luckiest and best things that's happened to me for sure.
And so, you know, you speak generally of being a lab technician and a research assistant. What do you have a particular field of study? Are you working on something interesting?
I guess the way it works in our lab and generally in the field is, like, if you take a master's in biochemistry or if you sign on to a lab, like, the supervisor, like the principal investigator, is going to have, like, a big overarching project which he has grant funding for, and then all of his grad students or technicians will be, like, assigned a subsection of that project. So in our lab, the overarching project is on a G protein coupled receptor called the apelin receptor, which is basically like a cell surface protein that straddles the surface of the cell. Like, half of this protein is outside the cell, half is inside the cell, and it sort of serves as a communication bridge between the outside and inside environments. So, like, as a receptor of apelin, it actually receives this little hormone, a peptide hormone called apelin, which kind of binds the receptor and activates it, whereby the receptor changes its shape, and then you get what's called a signal cascade inside the cell, basically leading to various physiological effects. So there's, like, more than 800 GPCRs in humans, including, like, the serotonin receptor and the dopamine receptor, the beta adrenergic receptors, which are used in treatment of heart disease and stuff like that, are all among this kind of overarching class of proteins called G-protein coupled receptors. And apelin receptor is just another example of GPCRs. And it's sort of, like, discovered a bit more recently, a bit more uncharacterized. Still, people have been working on it for maybe 20 years now, but they're basically, like, it's interesting because it's involved in, like, blood vessel dilation and constriction. Apelin is said to be inotropic, which means it makes your heart contract more forcefully. So this can be really useful in treating heart disease. So people are trying to understand how it works and unravel the sort of subtleties, I guess, of its binding apelin receptor, and also of, like, the signal cascade with the various different proteins that are involved once it's activated inside the cell.
So your course of research is principally this cell bridge, like this thing that bridges the cell, the thing that, like, the communication network.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. So that's really interesting. And is this? I'm sorry. Did you say this was a recent discovery that this thing existed?
So yeah, it's kind of like these words "recent" are definitely relative. In one sense, it's not all that recent because apelin was first discovered, I think, in 1988, and the receptor was discovered a few years later in 1993. But so that's like 27, 23, 22 years or something.
That's quite recent, I'd say.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And even more recently, like, a lot of the technologies that we have at our disposal to study it are really, like, a lot newer than that still. So many, many aspects of the protein and the signaling system are really being sort of fleshed out now. And still much is unknown. So that's sort of why it's a worthwhile and interesting thing to study for sure.
So what kinds of testing do you do with this receptor? Like, how do you, are you testing to see what it communicates and when it won't and when it will, kind of stuff?
Right. Yeah. Basically, those sorts of questions. Yeah. Like, we know, like, you know, we can think of it in a kind of a binary way. Like, the receptor exists in an off conformation, and then when it binds apelin, it turns on. And that's sort of a simplification in itself. But even with that in mind, then there's different, like, degrees of activation of the receptor. Like, how long the activation lasts. What are the secondary messengers or second messengers that get activated by the activated receptor? What are their cellular pathways and stuff? And sort of you won't have ever a single effect resulting from a biochemical event like this. You usually have, like, sort of a widening scope of things that are happening. So you always have, like, it's like dominoes where one domino is knocking over two other dominoes, and each of those is knocking over two dominoes, or they call two friends and then they call two friends, sort of thing. It basically, like, we're in the dark about a tremendous amount of things, it's very, like, yeah, it's very cool to kind of look at them and see which principles are specific to our receptor and which are like generalizable to GPCRs as a whole or like receptor signaling as a whole. And yeah, but yeah, basically like you can't look at things like with a snapshot with a camera, like the events are so small, like submicroscopic, that and the time scale is so fast that there's no way to sort of look at them visually. So you have to look at like a readout, like a functional measurement that sort of reflects something that happened, which often involves you trying very hard to control like 10 factors so that you can look at one changing factor. And trying to kind of like get a, like draw a conclusion from the changes you see in that one factor, that kind of thing.
Right. Okay. Now, whenever a songwriter like yourself or an artist like yourself has this other aspect to their life or their personality, even, the obvious question is, you know, does one impact the other? And when I think about this receptor and the communication going on, I think of some of your songs, and I want to get to that in a little bit. But I think as a general question, does your work in this scientific realm impact your songwriting or the way you approach music?
Sure, I do think so. I mean, I think that sort of no matter what you're doing, as like someone, like humans are always like expressing themselves, and when it comes to art, I think as honestly as it can be like a reflection of your experience in life, like, you know, that's good, and that's like reflecting some kind of like it's just a good thing, and a natural thing, I think. So so with that being said, for sure, like researching and studying science has had a big impact on me in terms of the songs that I write, like both in terms of like lyrical subject matter, because it's either like I'm thinking about the themes. Like one thing would be like thinking about the actual like biochemical processes and the perspective of like life and evolution, and kind of like not claiming to be an expert about those things at all, but certainly like at times like feeling a sense of like appreciation and wonder of like of scientific principles or of natural phenomena, is like that's huge. In terms of like, it's like that stuff is always going on miraculously, and we, myself included, like, you don't really tune into how incredible it is at most times, I guess. If like I could have songs that sometimes crystallize like my appreciation of those things and sort of like kindle a sense of appreciation in others, that would be an ideal thing. I mean, not that I necessarily have like a moral goal in creating songs, but so there's that side of things, that way in which being a scientist definitely influences it, because I have to think about that stuff like for so many hours a week that like it just naturally ends up in lyrics and stuff. And the other thing would probably be, other way it influences me would probably have to do with a sense of perseverance in the face of failure.
You're constantly experimenting, and so to speak, you know, in both realms. You're trying things out.
Exactly, yeah. And 9 times out of 10, or perhaps I would say 99 times out of 100, like something will go wrong or not strike in just the right way. And having like this structure and the routine around me that I had when I was in school, and now that I still have to some extent, like in my job at the lab, like and the sort of the support of like peers and a supervisor in a formal setting, like this has definitely helped me. And also like getting paid is like immensely like, it's actually like materially it's so necessary to live, and also like mentally, like it works, like it helps so much to feel like supported by your efforts or something, which is something that like you can get pretty discouraged playing music, getting money. I don't know. It's like, you know, yeah, not that you need much, but just that you, it's sort of some kind of like material validation.
Sure.
Money is weird anyway. Yeah. That's
money. Money is weird. Yeah. No, and I think another way I could have framed the original question is that, you know, you're working so dutifully and heavily in a micro world. I just wonder, and then I think your songs maybe represent a big picture. Maybe that's a simplistic way of looking at it, but it seems like you spend a lot of time immersed in microcosms, and then perhaps your songwriting is in a sense applying some of that research or that experience into bigger picture questioning.
Sure. Yeah. I would definitely hope for that. That would be my jam, is like looking at the microcosm and trying to like blast it open, and because otherwise, like, one of the biggest challenges I have in science is like feeling the relevance of what I'm doing, because yeah, we work with such sub-microscopic sort of things, and you're even within that, like, you ask yourself how relevant it is, because you're sort of artificially controlling so many factors that you're only looking at this one tiny thing. And if you don't have reminders like to give you perspective about how it fits into the big picture of science, it can get sort of like very dry. So yeah, so anything like, yeah, that's really nice to hear. It makes people that way. Yeah.
Can I ask you some lyrics questions?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Here's the first one. These are just lyrics that struck me as interesting, and I don't know if I have questions per se, but I want you to speak to some of these lyrics. So this first one that struck me: no man needs to care about another man's hair. Now that's from the song "No Man Needs to Care." That is a really cool turn of phrase. And quite loaded. Where did that come from? What does that mean to you?
Right. That's a pretty simple kind of I liked it, or I ended up doing that.
That's a bumper sticker. That's a bumper sticker waiting to happen. You guys need to get on that when you're that merch. If I see you guys and the merch table doesn't have that as a bumper sticker, I will be upset.
Jeez. It's like anything, like out of context, I'd be a bit shy about it, but I am, I stand by those lyrics for sure. Like that kind of, it came with a sense of like, yeah, sometimes you get a little bit, it's related to the theme of like delirium and persecution paranoia. The aspect of like, sometimes when you walk around, however you look, actually, I think maybe some people are blessed with the kind of natural confidence and self-assurance that they never sort of like worry about how they're perceived by other people. But certainly, like, yeah, if you look a bit like out there or whatever, like whether that's like, oh, you didn't have time to like comb your hair in the morning, or like if you have long hair, or if you have like a different kind of wardrobe, it reveals nothing about like your true identity as a human being. I mean, it's like a reflection of like who you are and the things that you like, and you know, you could probably make some guesses about what a person likes. You know, if they appear to be a guy with long hair, probably good guess that they like music, but like, you know, who doesn't like music, that kind of thing. But I think like I felt like at different times, and this could be at least half of it, is probably just me like, again, being paranoid that like the people are judging me when they like are just focused on their own lives and like not even noticing me. But other times I feel like, you know, a sense of like, yeah, like I guess like judgment or whatever, but in such a minor way that I can handle. But or like, you know what I mean? I wouldn't claim that this is a significant struggle or something. The only struggle is like when I internalize whatever feelings I have of like, you know, being misread or like being sort of categorized or labeled in like a way that like offends me.
Yeah, I want to home in a little bit on this paranoia and this judgment that you speak of, because I have more lyrics questions, and I think it pertains to what you were just describing. The next set of lyrics: not one of my friends sticks with me, not one of my friends is with me till the end. Most of my friends, they just diss me, they may dismiss me from a distance then. That's from the song "From the Night of the First Show" from the new album, or the reissued album. It's new, it's still new, it's the new album. Then the very next, right. The very next song is "Oh My Friends," and the first line is "Oh My Friends, it makes me glad to know you're beside me." So, a perfunctory reading of some of your lyrics and listening to the way they're delivered, I feel like you seem interested, if not obsessed, with social skills, lonerism. You tend to write, it seems to me at least, about external perception and social niceties and keeping up appearances for the sake of your friends. You kind of spoke to this. Is it just paranoia? Why does this kind of stuff interest you so much?
Right. Yeah, I think the short answer would be, for me, I mean, it's like human beings are tremendously important. In my experience, they're also like tremendously sensitive, like socially sensitive, especially like, you know, like, yeah, somebody could, a single thing, you know, like a single like interaction or like a glance from someone. I mean, I think people are like this to varying degrees, but it's true for everybody that like, you can really have your whole day change. Like if you have your feelings hurt, like even inadvertently by someone, which happens all the time, like people are just inadvertently hurting each other's feelings. That can like, you know, just totally change someone's mood, and their mood is like their momentary experience of the world, like what color the world is for them at that moment. It's definitely transient, which is something that we usually forget. But yeah, and by the same token, like a gesture of like warmth or kindness or like friendship from someone, is like, this can have like a completely the opposite effect. If you're feeling like, you know, way like lonely or whatever, like that kind of thing, you know, even a small thing from a relative stranger, like showing that they're not a stranger, like that can have such a huge impact on the quality or like the mood of your life at that time. And so I think knowing that, like, yeah, that's where my preoccupation comes from. And also like a great like insecurity and self-consciousness about like my own sort of like appearance or role like in the world with other people and sort of how I'm doing. And like I have both like, you know, a sense of like persecution if I'm wronged by someone or I get offended, or like a sense of like sort of guilt or something if I screw up or if I do something like sort of like self-involved or like, you know, egocentric and ignoring like the principles that really define the world, which are like total harmony or like total oneness or interdependence of everything, you know, when you have the false idea that you are like really important and that like, you know, your thoughts and feelings are like the reality and everything else is like some kind of like non-existent or non-reality thing. Like, so certainly if I catch myself with that kind of attitude, you know, I would feel guilty. And other times, though, if I catch people, you know, overriding me or like, or trying to hurt me or whatever, like, you know, I would get sensitive. So I think I try to work a lot of that stuff out in songs. And again, the short answer is that like people are so important. So like you really have to value them. And if you're not valuing them, like you got to sort of second guess like what you're doing, or you have to like kind of look closely and try to correct that, I think. I don't know.
Well, you know, I'm hearing you speak and thinking about some of your songs. I feel like you tend to discuss and write about human beings and people and reality in a somewhat detached manner. Do you feel sort of separated from the world at large? Do you feel kind of like an outlier somehow?
I think that that if my songs sort of kind of have that ring to them, or like, or if like the, if that's sort of a tone that comes across, then maybe that could be a good thing. I think for me, like psychologically, like that is of great value to me, to be able to create this like external piece of art or a song or something, and then also be singing it, so connected to it, like myself is like connected to this external thing that exists. But having it externalized in that way is something that I benefit greatly from, because honestly, no, like I feel like so immersed in the mire, in like the great anxieties and closeness and love with people, and also like fear of rejection, and also like, you know, like fear of like being an idiot or whatever, that those problems, you know, it probably comes through in my songs sometimes, it maybe in a more like anxious personal way, but for me to be able to get to a point of clarity where I can like see things like as I should see them, and I can kind of try and tune into that sort of perspective when I'm singing, but you have, it has to be honest too, so it has to have like a personal truth to it, otherwise you're just like, I guess, like, you know, like preaching from sort of like an empty sort of like standpoint or something. Mm-hmm. Just like whatever that word would be, like you're spouting off things, you're like, but you're not connect, they don't have no weight.
Yeah.
Something like that. Like,
yeah. I know where you're getting at for sure. Speaking of meaning you know, trying to grasp onto things, do you recall what first got you into music or poetry or lyric writing? Were there particular artists or sounds, or was there a moment in time where you were struck by something that compelled you to explore music?
Yeah, for sure. Like, always like songs, like since I was young, like, the first music that I kind of discovered on my own, or that I like kind of felt like a personal sort of relationship with, which sort of came after like me growing up with my family and like, you know, my dad playing like the Bob Dylan tape in the car, or like, you know, the Doors or something, like, was like later, like when I was maybe, I don't know how old, like maybe like 11 or 12 or something, like hearing like probably Green Day for the first time, like hearing Dookie, mm-hmm. and like just gradually, like at first it's kind of unfamiliar, but I was hearing that and just kind of like when the songs become more familiar, yeah, it just kind of gets more involved or something, like
when you heard Dookie by Green Day, do you recall if you were drawn to what was being said, or do you recall if it was more about the tone and the almost the stance that was being struck?
Yeah, I like it all. I love it all. That's the thing. It's like, yeah, they can't be extricated. And I ask myself the same question all the time, especially when I'm like evaluating my prowess as like a songwriter in comparison to the world, which I would love to, you know, this is sort of the egotistical, like, you know, tangent that you can go on sometimes. But yeah, you, it's always like that. Those are the times where I'm trying to critically like extricate or those two things, like sound and meaning, or like melody and lyric or whatever. But they're so together, I think, for me, that's the, what I always like when I find that, like I always come back to that. It's like I do love poems, and I love instrumental music, it's some kind of combination. And even beyond the melody and the lyric, it's like, yeah, something about the human voice and like the tone, like you said, the tone,
yeah,
of like Billy Joe's voice or something. It's like, yeah, that's sort of like transcendental level stuff sometimes. I mean, you know, when you're kind of receptive to it.
Yeah, I mean, some of the reference points that stuck out for me in hearing Nap Eyes for the first time, I don't know if they relate to you. I mean, I don't know if you would be able to relate to
Maybe you do. I mean, I'm hearing, you know, some Jonathan Richman, Modern Lovers stuff. I'm hearing some Lou Reed, Velvet Underground, a little bit of little bit of Pavement, maybe. Silver Jews, even. Like, so there's those kinds of things are there for me. Are they there for you?
Yeah, so much. You know, yes, like, yeah, for sure. yeah, and I, like, I can't really, like, this. It's sort of like, sometimes I feel like it's, like, it's not practical for me to, like, try to, like, put, like, boundaries on the kinds of songs that I like or, like, singing that I like or whatever, but those artists that you just mentioned now, like, I think they definitely all have in common, a certain personal depth to the lyrics and, like, coherence to the lyrics, and also, like, a very strong sort of, like, tonal emphasis in their voice. I don't know, like, yeah, like, sort of singing in this really way. Like, people say, like, oh, like, Bob Dylan's not, like, singing often so much as he's talking or whatever, which is sort of, like, a simplification, but what they're getting at, I think, is that, like, his voice sounds like the words sound like charged with conversational meaning or something. And I think that's true of all those artists that you mentioned. It sort of, like, in contradistinction would be something like opera, I guess, or like these sorts of, like, where classical music uses, like, a human voice as almost like as an instrument to express, like, the notes as purely as possible, and the text is there, but it's sort of secondary. I haven't yet gotten into opera, but, you know, like, my brother loves it, and, like, I know a lot of people love it, so I think that there's time for me one day. But,
well, yeah. I don't want to over flatter you or embarrass you. I don't really ask people lyrics questions specifically like this. I don't say, like, here's some lyrics that struck me, but I don't know. I was reading through there's a lyric sheet on this record, and yeah, it's that nice sweet spot of language where it feels conversational, but obviously really thought out. And I feel like there's a lot of, I had the same sentiments lately of Courtney Barnett or someone like her, where the writing is coming through almost stream of consciousness style, but I can tell there's been a lot of work done. And I feel that within your work. So I bring these things up, and I mention these references just to tell you that I appreciate where you're coming from. And the Dylan thing, I mean, I don't know if you're aware of this, I'm a gigantic Bob Dylan fan, like, a huge
sweet,
huge, like, I've seen him like 50 times, and
oh, amazing.
Yeah. Whoa. Love him, and I think he's the best singer and the best songwriter and all those things, and I think I can hear that. That conversational charge you mentioned is very well put. I think that's an interesting way of putting it, where it's just a person speaking particularly well, you know, like it's just like, that's a really compelling thing to say. And if someone said it to you over dinner, it would stick with you, kind of thing, you know?
Right. Right.
And I think that's what you're tapping into. Can you tell me what's the deal? What is the Mighty Northumberland? I was reading about this project. The Mighty Northumberland. This is you, right?
Sure, or at least it has been. it was, and it. I mean, it is in the sense of, like, certainly not anybody else.
This is your solo. This predates this band, right? It predates Nap Eyes. It's your solo work.
Yeah, pretty, I think, in a fairly cut and dry way. There might be a Mighty Northumberland release or two that happened sort of like after Nap Eyes first formed and started recording. But mostly it's been like, not always, but mostly like things that I was just like playing on my own, like usually with an acoustic guitar or like a classical guitar, where I would be singing and making recordings, like, without a lot of forethought, but sometimes, and just kind of, just really, like, not, often not with a lot of, like, repetition or what is the, what I mean to say
structure? Like, there wasn't a lot of structure.
not always a lot of structure, yeah. And I mean, so I would not recommend that anyone listen to that is what I was going to kind of get at. Unless you're sort of like, you know, like that's like kind of like you're interested in like seeing like a process or something.
Origin stories. Origin stories are very popular.
Yeah. We did some cool stuff. Like one of the things that Josh, who plays in Napa's, has drawn attention to is like we did this one recording for kind of a Hot Money release, which had I think like Long 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 and Josh's band Quivers and Mark and Scott's band Quaker Parents, I think at the time. We all did a song for like this 7-inch, and yeah, that was like a kind of a band thing for Mighty Northumberland, which we had done before that. So that was like the 7-inch song, and that's called Icegrass Underpass. And that song was pretty good, and it turned out well. Uh-huh. And then there was like earlier songs. We did this thing called like A Dream of Rivers. It's like, it would definitely feel a great amount of anxiety if someone would play any of that music or even like possess like the physical media containing that music within like 50 meters of me. So yeah, but it's cool. Like it's, you know, it's the past.
Basically what you're saying is if Napa's really blows up, look to eBay for these Mighty Northumberland releases and you'll probably.
Yeah. If you have a sort of like I could see a few reasons for wanting to do that. But,
unloading your Mighty Northumberland records for big scratch. Yeah, I can see that being. Now you mentioned Josh there. How did you end up collaborating with Josh and Seamus from Monomyth?
I guess the short answer there is that those guys are my really good friends. They sort of, they want to have like, I mean, certainly I hope I never put like too much strain on the relationship, but they stuck with me since high school is when we first met each other. Maybe with Seamus even a bit earlier. And then Brad too, like we met, I think when I was going into grade 11 or something.
This is Brad Loheed?
Yeah, Brad Loheed, yeah.
Lahead? Yeah. Sorry, Lahead. I apologize. Yeah.
No, that's cool. Yeah.
Brad's so kind of an Brad's a kind of an occasional member of the band. Is that how it works?
Brad is like our ideal fourth member. He's there on almost all of our recordings except for those like four track recordings like Tribal Thoughts and Joint Uppers and stuff, which you might find on Bandcamp. But for the most part, any recording we've done has been with Brad. He's also anytime it's possible for us to go play shows together, we always do. But because of circumstance and because Brad is, playing in like he lives in Montreal, and he also plays in like a bunch of different bands and stuff. It hasn't always been possible to tour together, logistically. But yeah, hopefully in the future, like more and more possible. So, but anyway, like, as a rule, I guess we've toured as either a three-piece or a four-piece, and both have like kind of a unique sound. And so right now we're here in Idaho as a three-piece, but Brad is going to come meet us in Chicago in a couple nights, and then we're going to play the last few shows, like five or six shows of the tour with Brad. So yeah.
By the way, you mentioned. Sorry to cut you off there, but you mentioned Chicago. I would like to point out that. Research has indicated that Ronald Reagan was actually born in Illinois, not Idaho, which is a state I just invented. So I didn't mean to interrupt your train of thought, but that was a late breaking bulletin. Ronald Reagan from the state of Illinois.
There we go.
There you go. Sorry. So Brad is cool. An occasional member and Monomyth you grew up with, and it just makes sense that you would all play together.
Yeah. Just old friends and I felt like, yeah, definitely sympathetic minds musically, and socially, I think those guys really understand me because they've seen me, like, we've known each other through, I think, a lot of different times. And so, yeah, there's a certain like staying power there. And I'm so glad to be playing with all of them.
Cool. It's good. I think that social aspect. I mean, given what we were talking about earlier and your weird songs about your friends, I think it's good that you can come back around and be like, it's fun to play with my friends. It's important to me.
Yeah.
Otherwise,
yeah, totally.
I'd be worried otherwise.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. It's like, yeah, it's one of the best things. And working together with people on something, like, aside from just, like, you know, chilling or having a party or something, like, which is also so important and fun, it's great to have this, like, spirit of cooperative endeavor where you're working together towards a common goal.
Yeah.
That really helps. Yeah.
You've had the unique experience of releasing a small run of vinyl records of this release that we've been discussing, Wine of the Mystic. And I luckily have one of those original pressings. I think I have this thing on vinyl, but it's now out via two labels. You've changed records and Paradise of Bachelors, which I mentioned earlier, which is cool. That's great. But I also understand that a new Napbeyes album is in the can, and I've heard you already, or rather read that you've already described it as being a bit quite different than this one in some ways. Can you expand upon that?
Yeah, I guess I won't say it's because it's hard to describe stuff like that.
Sure. I've heard quieter or slower, or I don't know what softer. I don't know what the term is that I've.
Yeah. Those things are I'd say all valid descriptors. It's pretty different. We like the recordings are it's different. Definitely, we were playing way quieter. I think is one of the first things people will notice.
Do you know what prompted that?
I think it was mostly, I mean, but like partly the songs themselves and like our mood, and definitely partly the setting that we recorded them in. We recorded in Nova Scotia, up at my parents' house at near Pictou, and it just kind of like felt good to play quieter. The room, it's like, sounded nice, and when we recorded Wine in the Mystic at Drones Club in Montreal, which is sort of like our friend's like big like rehearsal / jam / show, like DIY show / recording space, that's just a room that it makes more sense to play loud there, and you're in the city where things are generally louder and stuff. So I don't know, like environmental factors have a big influence, I think, on recordings, especially like just recording performances live. Is like,
I mean, you describe them as environmental factors. It just sounds like kids who don't want to make their parents mad.
Yeah, it was kind of definitely like that was part of the decision. I mean, we had like my parents were sort of away at the time, but
neighbors, you can't upset the neighbors. They'll tell your parents,
exactly.
Then you won't hear the end of it.
Exactly. Yeah,
I know what it's like. So. I know what it's like. I have parents. And I am a parent. I know exactly what you're talking about. And I can understand now why the album's quieter. You didn't want to get grounded. I mean, why don't you just say the truth? I think you should just be honest about it. All right, well, so, and the new record is coming out in January?
Yeah, it's looking like January, maybe February, but I think January, yeah.
Does it have a title?
It does. I don't know. I maybe won't mention it now, which seems silly, but...
Isn't it weird? You got all these labels now and publicists. You can't say... That's the interesting shift, isn't it? You've got to keep things a bit closer to the... That's so funny. It's so interesting to me. It's just because it's fair. I'm not making fun of it. I think you need to respect everyone's work. So, particularly your parents. We've already talked about how you don't want to make your parents angry. You sign on to two labels,
right.
You got a mom and a dad. You got new parents. Or two dads, two moms. I'm open-minded. I just think that's interesting. All right, well, no, it's good. But it's done. Is the record done?
It's done, yeah. It's recorded, mixed, and mastered. So it's all ready. And, we're working on our work now. And, yeah.
Okay.
But I think everything should go okay in terms of the timeline, hopefully.
So you've got a reissue circulating now. You've got another record done that won't be out until January. What is next for Napbeyes beyond touring and promoting this record and then the next record? Are you already working towards a new record and new songs?
I think so. I mean, yeah, there's so much. Like, this has been a real, like really shaking things up from their usual routine since since you've changed it and Paradise of Bachelors got sort of working with us, and now we have, you know, like a lot of like uncertainty and it's exciting, like what, as to what will happen over the next few months with touring and stuff. Hopefully something, but I'm not expecting, trying not to expect too much or too many different things, because there's no point.
Sorry, are you referring to, are you referring to, the reception of all of these things? Is that what you mean? You're trying not to worry about what people think and what they, how they, whether or not they cover the records and all that stuff. You're just trying not to think about that.
Absolutely.
Stuff. Yeah. No, that's fair. Yeah. Why would you think about that? It's not none of your concern. You just got to make your work.
Yeah, it should be. Yeah. And it, yeah, it's a very like natural temptation to be like, and then this will happen, or like, on like, and that'll be great, or like, and then this will happen and it will be terribly sad. And both of those are sort of like pointless avenues of thought.
Things
where
seem
you could be spending your concentration better.
Things seem to be working out. You've had profiles in what, Stereo Gum maybe or something?
Yeah.
Noisy, I know, I saw that. Cool. Yeah. Okay. I mean, the press is paying attention, and for whatever that's worth these days, that's good.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah,
I'm excited. Yeah.
Do you miss the lab when you're away from work? Do you miss your scientific work when you're on tour and stuff?
To be honest, I don't have like time really. I feel like the one thing that I miss at home is like my loved ones and my family, like my friends and stuff. That I really miss, like, and then I just feel like tour is like so immersive that like, and I probably miss in some kind of like general sort of gut feeling way, like the structure and the routine that I get like working in the lab and stuff. And I miss my friends there and the supervisor. Yeah. But in terms of the work, like this is, I love playing shows every night, and I really like, I love thinking about this kind of side of my life. Like it is really, I'm really glad to be here.
If you have like a eureka moment about your lab work on the road? Has that happened? You're like, wait a second.
Maybe that happens to some people. I feel like it's not slated to happen for me. But you know, it could, like, I feel like I could have eureka moments about like things to approach or like ways to adjust my personal attitude, but not so much about like scientific explanations for like why my protocol has not been working as I need it to work or whatever, because I just don't have time to troubleshoot or to think about that stuff. My mind doesn't naturally rest on those things, whereas my mind does naturally rest on like what music is playing in the car or like where we're going to go and find food or like coffee before we do the next thing, or like how late we're going to be for the show or whatever.
Yeah.
So yes, there's not as much time. I think you need sort of moments of quiet concentration.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Well, once again, the latest Nat Baez record is called Wine of the Mystic. And I'm holding it in my hand right now. And it's available now via You've Changed Records and Paradise of Bachelors. And you can see the band live in, I believe the dates are Windsor, Hamilton, and Toronto between the 15th and 18th of July. Is there more? I thought there was a Guelph date somewhere.
There is, yeah. Guelph, if it's not listed, it's the 16th in Guelph. So Windsor on the 15th, Guelph the 16th. Then Hamilton and Toronto.
On the 7th, okay,
17th. Guelph is like incline, decline? Yeah,
that's right. That's right. The Incline Decline Festival. I just didn't see it listed anywhere on your, at least, I don't know.
And that's your home, right? Is that where you live?
Yeah, I live at the Incline Decline Festival. It's weird.
Cool.
It's very messy and very loud all the time. No, I live in Guelph. Yeah, I'll be here. I think we briefly met for the first time in Guelph when you played a show at the Silence venue.
Amazing. Yeah.
So I was mostly catching up with Josh, whom I've encountered in my stalking of Monomyth. I don't know why I put it that way, because I certainly am not stalking them, but I like Monomyth and will see them whenever I can. So Josh and I were catching up, but I feel like you and I said hello at least. And Yeah, yeah. And I'm looking forward to seeing the band. So, the 16th in Guelph as well. And the other dates are Windsor, Hamilton, and Toronto. And for more information, people can visit youvechangedrecords.com. Let's just send people there. Now, is there a song from Wine of the Mystic that we can go out on there, Nigel? Is there something we can play?
Oh, yeah, anything you want. I don't really mind.
No,
yeah.
I know that. That's a good answer. That is a very diplomatic answer. But is there something that you would recommend?
If you have, like, I don't know how much time you have, but if you have, like 7 to 8 minutes, you could play Delirium if you want, but you could also play...
Delirium, like, and Persecution. Thoughts, yeah. No, we can do whatever you want. Delirium and Persecution Paranoia, that's the song you wanted to play?
Yeah, sure.
Why did that come to mind?
I don't know. I like that one. Brad's doing some crazy stuff on guitar. You have a nice groove that lasts through the song. I like sitting that one too. Like, is this kind of pertinent? I don't know.
You play it live?
Yeah. When Brad's around, sometimes.
Okay.
But yeah, it's another difficult one because our set's maybe half an hour, and that's like a good quarter of it right there. So yeah.
Well, don't you know what they say? F the clock, my friend. F the clock. You can do whatever you want. All right. This is Delirium and Persecution Paranoia by this great band from Halifax, Snap Eyes. And Nigel, it was a pleasure to speak with you, and good luck on the road. And you know, we'll see you soon, I hope.
Thanks, Vish. So great to talk to you, too. Thank you.
Hey, thanks again for checking out Creative Control with Vish Khanna. You can email me about the show at creativecontrol933@gmail.com. That's creative with a K, control with a K, 933@gmail.com. You can also follow our Twitter at Vish Creative, VishKreative. And you can also like our Facebook page. A version of this show airs on CFRU in Guelph every Wednesday at noon Eastern. And you can listen to that online at cfru.ca, or if you're in the KW region, at 93.3 FM in Guelph. You can also sign up for the weekly mailing list for the podcast and the show at vishkhanna.com, and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. I believe that is everything I wanted to tell you. Thank you once again.